comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, the show that's here because you have a right to know and you matter. There was a scheduling mix-up last night. We have been able to determine it was actually neither my fault nor Marshall's fault. And I won't get into the details, let it suffice to say that Marshall Masters is with us tonight. And we're going to be treated, I am certain, to some very captivating information, as always. So I look forward to our conversation with Marshall Masters here in just a little bit. If you're new to the show, you probably don't know that we have a free weekly newsletter called The K-Files. So if you go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and look right in the middle of the screen, you'll see a big, bold word that says K-Files. Now, if you click that, you can subscribe in just a matter of a few seconds, and I encourage you to do that. The new members community that we're constructing is coming along quite nicely, and we'll be in our new digs in the not-too-distant future. Right now, of course, is the time to join because you can lock in the prices as they are right now for the next year. So if you join tonight, it's $6.95 a month. When we open our new members community, it's got a lot of new features, and it goes up to $7.50 a month. It's the first price increase we've had since we've had the members area open, but it is well worth far, far, far more than $7.50 a month. Nevertheless, you can lock it in for the next year at $6.95 a month by joining before we open the new members community. So I encourage you to do that right now. Also, I encourage you to check our Kevin Smith Show freebies. We're running a little test, and if people respond to it, we'll continue it. If they don't, then we won't. That's what the tests are for when we run tests. But if you click on the KSS Freebies link, you can download a couple of shows that, and this is video, okay? So you can download it in Windows Media format or in iPhone, Android format. A couple of shows, and they are sizzlers. I think these are a couple of shows you'll want to have for your very own, and they are, of course, free downloads. So avail yourself of that. All right, we're going to step out of here in just a few seconds. We're going to step out for a break. We'll, during that break, get everything all fixed up, lined up, and ready to roll here. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Marshall Masters. Marshall Masters is, of course, best known, I guess, because of his series about 2012. We're going to be talking about that and other things on the other side of this break. Don't go away. Well, Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, as I said, is Marshall Masters. He is with us on the telephone line. And, Marshall, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
It's a pleasure to be back, Kevin.
Marshall, you saw the graphic that I have on the website about tonight's show, and I just entitled it The Approach. The reason is because even though I guess people, a lot of people know you for your work on 2012, Planet X, so forth, Nibiru, and that may be the avenue by which they are familiar with you, but that's not all that you research. It's not the only thing you're involved in. And as we are actually approaching the year 2012, folks, if you haven't noticed, that's 4 months away. As we're approaching 2012, there are other things that appear to be approaching us. We've seen an increase in weirdness on the sun and around the sun. Increase, it appears, in earthquake activity, and it's the severity of the earthquake activity. We are watching the approach of Comet Elenine. Coming in behind that, Comet Honda. And coming in behind that, just a couple of months, 3 or 4 months later, another comet whose name escapes me at the moment. All making close passes near the Earth. So that's why I called tonight's show The Approach. It just seems like everything is approaching. And just in general, I want to get you to give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of what you think about all those things I've mentioned. Am I connecting dots that should not be connected?
No, you're connecting dots that are connecting themselves. I'll have to tell you, I mean, we've been doing a lot of research on Comet Elenine. I have the PlanetXTownHall.com group and a series of researchers who are working with me on this, and we're really tackling it. We're trying to follow the science. And when Comet Elenine's story first broke, I have to be honest with you. I mean, I was like a lot of other researchers, and I was taken aback by, well, the voluminous amount of disinformation being pumped, and that immediately made me suspicious. And so they had Comet Elenine being Planet X, a brown dwarf, an alien ship under control, et cetera, et cetera. It was like somebody said, okay, let's jump on this and pull every theory, as wild as it may be, off the shelf, and let's pump it out there. And it was very, very unusual. And I published an article on Yowz, I believe, back in May, my first one, which was, is Comet Elenine a decoy? And the reason I was really concerned, what started me following it, was if it is a decoy, then what is it being used to distract our attention from?
Mm-hmm.
And that is the key question for me. So, you know, I formed this group, and we all started digging into this thing. And what we found with Elenine is it's a story that just wouldn't go the heck away. And I'm telling you something. I really did want it to go away. I was tired of it. There's been times I just wanted to walk away. And then, dang, something else comes up. And on my Yow radio show, this is where I just do the research. And, you know, I mean, compared to you, we're a Pudknocker show. And a bunch of guys just sitting there scratching their heads and out loud and thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, there's nothing wrong with that.
And hours of doing that. And here's the basic summary of what we think with Elenine. First off, we're not seeing that it's an alien spaceship. We're not seeing that it's Planet X. We're not seeing any of these other things that are being spun. But what we are seeing is a pattern with this that is creating concern. In, you know, if you, for example, look at the Blue Kachina Hopi prophecy, and I think the Hopis are a very, very good source of prophecy. As an indigenous species, you know, they've been, you know, around as a coherent civilization long before we were.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and this folklore and tradition has carried through, and I know that the Hopi have different prophecies about these times, and also the Hopi prophecy rock. So we really kind of focused at a point about midway into the research of the blue star, because an odd thing when we were looking at, you know, it was an interesting idea, and then what we started doing was digging into it, because one of the researchers remembered that the comet Holmes in 2007 had been designated as the Blue Kachina. Now, in the prophecy, what they say is the Blue Kachina comes first, and it scares the dickens out of us. We know it's time to go back to the old ways, and essentially it's a time of redemption. The Blue Kachina is the one that really does the damage, and it follows, you know, behind that, say, within a time frame of a year. So then when we look at this and we see that, according to a third-party source, the Mayan elders designated Comet Holmes in 2007 as the Blue Kachina unmasking. And for those of you who might remember, Comet Holmes had it came in, it was a very innocuous comet, nothing, it was kind of wimpy really, and it was out there, never got any closer to us than, you know, the belt, the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. So, I mean, there was never any risk of it coming close enough to be a real concern for us. But it did something nobody expected it would do. It had a sudden energetic outburst, and for a moment of time, it was the brightest object in the night sky. Period. And it also had a coma that expanded to approximately the diameter of the sun. That's huge. So we're looking at Comet Elenin, and it was interesting. We're going through, and we were really slugging through all of the problems with Comet Elenin. And there's one guy, Terrell Croft, who actually was in our first show, and he was, you know, it's Planet X, and he was absolutely dead certain about it, and we weren't. And we, you know, once we disagreed with him, oh man, he just went sour grapes, and that was a problem. And now, I mean,
that does happen in this business, you know.
It does happen, and Terrell now is giving Bible lessons with Comet Elenin. I don't know. I mean, it's like kind of like, hello, what happened to the science? You know, toodles. But we knew that he would implode, and he's imploding. But still the same, you know, we spent a lot of time trying to trace down this allegation that the Comet Holmes was the Blue Star Kachina, and we never could attribute it directly to the Hopi, period. I mean, the Hopi have really clammed up on a lot of this. I mean, they're making ready, they're in preparation. All right, that's it. They told the White Eyes as much as they could, and the White Eyes said, you know, hey, go back to the reservation and run a casino, get lost. And so that's all. The Hopi are quiet. We could not find any linkage. So this was part of folklore. There was no direct linkage. But Holmes did this amazing outburst, and this last week, Comet Elenin did the same thing. And Comet Elenin is now brightening considerably, and its coma at this point, as we're talking, is estimated to be the size of the planet Jupiter.
Okay, right. Now, are we sure that Elenin is brightening, or is that a function of that it's getting nearer to us?
Well, this is a sudden brightening. And this is one where you have a really rapid expansion of the coma.
Okay.
So this is not what was expected. The comet is evidencing behaviors that were not expected. I can remember Ed Douglas in our research group was the one that came with the comet capacitance theory of that we have electric, you know, we have an electric universe takeoff. And we got a lot of folks who said they knew better telling us we were idiots 3 days after Ed comes on and talks about that while Elenin was still in wimpy state. Boom, this thing lights up big time, all right? And so we know this object, if you're willing to accept the fact that we live in an electric universe. Now, is there an argument for comets being electrical? Yes. You look at, you've seen directed energy approach that the government is using now for new weapons.
Yes.
And one in particular is that there's the denial system that the Army uses where they can broadcast like a heat wave at people and they feel that their skin's on fire and they run away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a directed energy weapon. It's a takeoff on a maser. Well, the thing of it is there's a difference between lasers and masers. A laser is invisible light spectrum. Masers are much broader. And so you don't necessarily see a maser. But it works. Now, the thing is that astronomers know that comets do behave at times as cosmic masers, as do some types of suns and other celestial objects. So this is something that is observed. So the question then becomes, is Elenin going to have a maser effect? That's something that we're delving into. We're not ready to talk about that directly, but there's no question in my mind that, especially with the recent brightening. So where does that come to us? Well, there's a date that is a real thorny date with Elenin, 9/11. This one pops up again. And on 9/11, two things are happening in this narrow point of time. One, Elenin is going to be at perihelion, which is its closest distance to the sun. Aphelion is its furthest. The second thing is that it is crossing the ecliptic. Now, for your listeners, to visualize the ecliptic in your mind, imagine you're in the center of the sun. Ooh, yeah. You know, that's where you need SPF 9 gazillion.
Yeah, yeah. And some ice water.
There you go. Mm-hmm. And so there you are in the center of the sun, and you got a hula hoop around you. And what you do is you just take that hula hoop and stretch it all the way out from the center of the sun to the 12 constellations of the zodiac. That is the plane of our system. That, essentially, is the ecliptic. And what's happening?
Well, it's the basically it's the
closest to the sun.
It's the equator of the solar system.
Yeah. It's essentially the equator of the solar system, and it's the plane of the system.
Uh-huh.
And what's happening is that on 9/11, it is crossing the ecliptic. At the same time, it is coming to its closest distance to the sun, and this then, you know, this we've seen, for example, in 2000, you could find on my site an article about comet S4 Linear, I believe. And what we documented early in the last decade was that comets, when they're passing through the ecliptic, can sometimes just behave like they hit a brick wall and shatter because they're going from one polarity to the other. So now you have this comet at its closest distance to the sun plus crossing the ecliptic. The question is will that trigger a massive outburst similar to the one of 2007 Common Homes? And if so, what does it mean? Well, one thing about Common Homes was that it was at a comfortable distance. It was beyond the orbit of Mars. Comet Elenin around this time is, you know, a little bit further on where it comes to its closest distance to the Earth. It is going to be between us and Venus, much closer to Venus distance-wise. So we have this different proximity. The comet, in terms of the cores, are roughly the same. Elenin is a little larger than Holmes was. But we have quite a few of these things. Now, there's also a researcher out there, Omers Bosch, who, and I have written an analysis of his theories where he's talking about celestial alignments between Elenin, the Sun, and Earth being causing recent seismicity. If you take his data and dump half of it, assuming it's not there, the other half really does stand on coincidence, and so there is a prima facie case for that. So we're looking at all of these things with the thought of if there is a sudden outburst or an interaction with the Sun like arcing. I mean, what we're talking about is something that is huge, blue, and sudden, which goes to the Hopi prophecy that the blue China will suddenly unmask itself and it'll scare the hell out of us. So that is what we're looking at there. In general, what we're seeing is that Earth is right now, our seismicity levels are really growing. You know, we're literally, there's a little program that your listeners can get and download for free. It's called Earthquake 3D or Quake 3D. You can look it up on Google. They also have a paid version that's for, like, researchers myself. There are a little few extra bells and whistles, but the free package really is great for most anybody that wants to do this. And the thing about it is that you can see the globe, you can see all the recent data coming in with quake activity on the globe, and it's you see our planet differently. You see earthquakes differently. You see a very definite pattern where there's a tremendous amount of seismicity on plate boundaries right now. The Ring of Fire is on fire. There are quake swarms, threes and fours, that are going off like popcorn in a subsea area off the coast of Puerto Rico.
All right, we have to step away for break, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes here. More with Marshall Masters, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Kevin Smith Show, like no other talk radio on earth.
Welcome back to The Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Marshall Masters. And Marshall, we were talking about, as we went to break, you were talking about the Ring of Fire is on fire. Now, I have a question in relation to Comet Elenin, and that is the approach of Comet Elenin linked to this uptick in earthquakes, or is this just coincidentally happening at the same time? I mean, is there any kind of a direct link between them?
Well, you know, you could argue for both sides of that issue. Both points are legitimate at this point. You know, keep in mind, there's a lot about comets we still don't know. You know, astronomy still looks at them as dirty snowballs, but in what we saw in this Dr. Omer Spash paper, personally, I don't care for the man personally at a human level, but I have to respect the work because it did make a prima facie case for the, you could call it coincidence, but I mean, he goes through the dates and he goes, here's a celestial alignment, this happens. Here's a celestial alignment, this happens. But on the other hand, you know, there's a third possibility, is that it is not just Elenin, but it is something behind Elenin that's following, that there's actually a triple punch here instead of a double punch.
Okay, what are we talking about, something behind Elenin? Because, and let me say...
Planet X.
Oh, Planet X, okay. Well, I saw a movie that... shows the photographs of Comet Elenin taken over a period of days, showing its movement, and they line them up and compress it into a movie. And when you watch this, there are two other objects, at least two others, that are also moving with Elenin. You can see it in these photographs from the telescopes. What about that? What's up with these objects moving with Elenin?
Well, there's no reason why you can't have a cluster of objects. All right, you know, I was talking earlier about S4 Linear, and it completely, you know, came apart when it was passing through the ecliptic, and I believe in 2000. You could have had a similar thing where Elenin did that, and all these objects, though, are still moving together. It's one of those things where we're going to know better as this comes into view. I think one of the things that we found interesting in terms of disproving the notion that this is a brown dwarf or a large planet several times the size of Earth is that amateur astronomers have performed an acid test that was actually rather smartly done and very well and compassionately presented. It was very respectful. And what they did was they said, fine, we know this object, where it is in space, and there are asteroids that have been cataloged, and their orbits are going to bring them in close proximity. So if this is a massive object like a brown dwarf sun, an unborn sun, as some maintained, or it is a huge, massive planet, as others have maintained, then it would stand to reason that the orbit, known orbit, very well published, of this, of these asteroids, would be perturbed in some way, which was not the case. There were the flybys of these known asteroids going past Elenin, and their orbits were not perturbed in any way. It was stuck with the ephemeris. So, you know, we're still dealing with a comet-like object. But again, what's really concerning for us is it's packing a wallop in terms of built-up energy.
And well, I think there's a possibility of something else to be concerned about, not to replace that concern, but in addition, and that would be these objects that are moving with Elenin, and I'm not making this up. These are in the photographs that were taken by professional telescopes tracking Elenin, and there are objects that are moving with it. Okay, so when NASA tells us that here's the track it's going to take, it's going to miss us by, I think, 23 million miles, something like that, which, though, in astronomical terms, is a very close shave. So, maybe all of that is true. So Elenin misses us, but what about these sister objects that are moving with it? They're not in line right behind it. Is it possible that one of them may hit the Earth?
Well, that is there's a concern there, because Comet Elenin is coming we're going to, it's an Earth crosser, all right? It crosses the orbit of Earth, and we could very well fly through its tail, and there could be debris in that tail, and at that point, you don't know how big it is. It could be just a nice fancy light show, you know, like the meteor showers,
mm-hmm.
or we could wind up with a number of impact events. So, you know, the fact that it is broken up as a multiple object, and I think, you know, I've seen that imagery too, that is also a concern. It's, and here's the thing of it is, we're seeing those objects that are trailing with it. But what about the objects that are too small to be detected?
Mm-hmm.
You know, remember, you know, the Tunguska meteorite in 1908 was estimated to be about, it wasn't that big, all right? It was a stony rock, and it was something that it would be small enough, you know, like today, we think, okay, well, if something like the Tunguska impactor were coming at us, we'd see it, no problem. Wrong. Because we don't have telescopes that are going to get to anything unless it's a mile in diameter. All right? It's got to be a pretty big rock. Now, there was a reason for that. It was explained to me by Dr. Brian Marsden, who recently passed away and not too long ago, and fine gentleman at the Smithsonian. And the reason why that size of object was chosen was when it came time to funding the projects, they went and said, what do we have for available resources? And instead of getting the telescopes that the team wanted to go out and actually do a good and proper size sky survey, they took what was available, and that was as big a rock as they could find with what's available. So a Tunguska, and I mean, Tunguska was such a big impact, the light from the explosion was, they were able to read newspapers in Paris, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And
by the way, folks, that's not a hyperbole. They actually were. It lit up the night in Paris, and Tunguska is in Siberia. Lit up the sky in Paris bright enough for them to read the newspaper at night on the street by the light of the Tunguska blast.
That's right. And so, and that is a rock that today we wouldn't see it coming. Or maybe they're going to see it coming, but not until it's right upon us. So, you know, your point is well taken. There's other objects floating around with this thing, trailing behind it, leading it alongside it. But my concern is not the ones that we're seeing tracking with it. My concern is the ones we can't see tracking with it.
Okay, so... Yeah. When do you think we're going to be able to see Elenine in our sky?
Well, I mean, there is, when you're talking about when do we see Elenine, you know, we're supposed to see it, depending on estimates. I mean, I've seen August, I've seen September, something where it's supposed to be visible in the early morning hours, and you know, you'll have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go out and take a look at it, and it'll be barely visible to the naked eye, and that's quote unquote the official position. But now with this sudden brightening we've had in the last few days, that's a different thing. Also, the velocity of the comet Elenin is changing. It's approaching its point of perihelion, which means it's speeding up. So, you know, these things don't run on a train schedule. They're pretty accurate, but there can be leeway, and comets can do very unusual things. I mean, a good example was Hale-Bopp, which on its way back out of the inner system, all right, it passed close enough to Jupiter that its orbit was reduced by 40%. That is a huge change. That is a massive perturbation. Interestingly enough, Hale-Bopp, the distance between Hale-Bopp and Jupiter that Jupiter could create that effect, that perturbation on Hale-Bopp, is approximately the same distance that Elenin will be to the Earth when it approaches its closest point to the Earth in late September.
So what they're saying,
more concerned about is solar interaction, but also, yes, I agree that there's we have to consider what happens if we fly through a debris field.
All right. To make sure I understand what you're saying here, Elenin is going to fly something like... Folks, I could be wrong about this. It's been a while since I did those shows on Elenin, but I'm remembering, and I hope I'm remembering correctly, that it's going to be about 23 million miles away from Earth, which is very close. Are you saying that we may or may not be able to see this with the naked eye? And if we cannot, then this thing is really pretty small, isn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, it's always been a position of NASA that we would eventually be able to see it with the naked eye. All right,
okay.
So it's not something we wouldn't see. Now that it's brightening, now that its coma is, in diameter is equal to that of the planet Jupiter, this is going to definitely be naked eye visible. But here's the thing that we're concerned about. And again, I mean, I have to preface it for your listeners, is that, you know, there's a mountain of what we don't know about comets and very little what we actually do beyond, you know, dirty snowballs and electric universe theory. So you're having to say, okay, how is this behaving in relationship to other objects that, you know, in similar circumstances, which is what we've been doing in our research. The thing that, no matter exactly how close, it is going to be, it's going to be closer to us than the planet Venus. And if it has an outburst similar to the one that Holmes experienced in 2007, its coma will expand to the diameter of the Sun. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And that means it's going to be interacting with the Sun. Our biggest concern really is going to be the solar interaction between the two objects. Is it going to set off some really nasty solar storms? And worse yet, is it going to point those buggers in our direction?
All right, we'll take up that question when we come back from this break. We will return, folks, so hang in there. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Marshall Masters. And Marshall, let me let you just pick up where you left off talking about Elenin there.
Okay. Well, you know, we're at a point right now with the team. We finally, you got to at some point in this, you have to take a snapshot of the data that you have available, and then you have to just paint a picture of what you think it's going to be, and that's we're in the process of doing it, and we will be publishing a YouTube video on that on my Yowbooks channel, Yowbooks, so if folks want to subscribe to it, they'll know as soon as it's up, but as soon as we do post it, you'll be the first to know, I can promise you that, and I can tell you that, you know, within my own team, the debates are vigorous. This is a tough topic, and we're not trying to make up anybody's mind for them. But we did have one bit of we went out on a limb with our concerns about the capacitance discharge, and we were brutally beat on that, which is fine. That's life. You know, you got to keep following your science. And as it turned out, we actually were on the money.
Galileo got put in house arrest for being right. If you get brutally beat up, it's a pretty good sign you were right.
Yeah, you know, you've run afoul of somebody's special interest, so mm-hmm. you know that's the way that goes. But I think the big concern right now we have is our biggest worry is solar interaction, the potential for that. Our second greatest worry is going to be if we have some sort of cosmic maser effect, what that could do with volcanism seismicity. In other words, let's say it pops off that close, you know, if that's the case, then what kind of seismic events could that trigger around the globe? Because right now, I mean, if you're following it, you know, we're having a 6.0 and sometimes more than one 6.0 plus a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been tracking this stuff for a long time. That's not business as usual. Mm-mm. No, sir. Plus,
all right, well, let's go back to what you just mentioned, solar interaction. What are we talking about with solar interaction? Describe what kind of an event that would possibly be.
Well, it's going to be a painful event. You know, I mean, NASA has quibbled back and forth about the solar maximum of 2012 and 2013. And on one hand, some voices in NASA are going, this thing is going to hurt like heck. It could cause another, like, solar storm of 1859. And others are going, well, no, we don't see it, you know. But all of a sudden now this week, NOAA has come out and said the same thing, that we could have solar storms in 2012, 2013 that are great as the solar storm of 1859. So let's ask the question for the benefit of the listeners. What was the solar storm of 1859? Well, back mm-hmm. then, the height of technology in the day, the bleeding edge, if you will, was telegraph. And it had only been out there for a few years, and a lot of entrepreneurial firms were stringing cables across the United States and through Europe. Now, when the solar storm of 1859 popped off, what happened was there were thousands of fires all along those lines because of the shorting causing fires, sparking, arcing, boom. So everybody had all problems with fires. But what was really interesting was that in Hawaii, they were seeing the aurora borealis. It was that powerful. Now, if we have another solar storm along the lines of the 1859 event, we're talking about losing a major, major share of our satellite communication networks, losing if our power grids are up and operational when something like this hits, we could lose a good chunk of them, and we're not talking about like a little short brownout or a blackout. We are talking about a huge loss of transformers, which are very big, very expensive, and it takes a long time to replace them. So there could be parts of the country that are going to live in perpetual brownout if they're lucky, and the rest won't see any power for months. And in the poorer nations of the world that can't afford to compete for these expensive transformers, it could be years before they see electricity again. So that's a concern. Now, here in the United States, it's like, okay, so we're out of power, get the Rayovacs, you know, light it up, I got my Coleman, what's the problem? Well, the problem is we are a highly energy-dependent civilization, period. You take away power, transportation grinds to a halt, water purification grinds to a halt, sewage grinds to a halt. I mean, you just go down the list, one thing after another. And the result of something like that is in your cities, the cities will just turn into huge death centers where diseases can run rampant, you know, no differently than we're seeing, you know, in third world areas like Somalia. We could have that kind of a situation without power.
One of the things I hear people say is, well, as I'm ready for it. I've got a generator. Well, unless you've got about 5 years' supply of fuel for that generator, you're going to be without electricity very shortly because generators burn a lot of fuel. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about gasoline or if you're talking about diesel. I know because I've lived where we use generators. Fill the tank up, and you're looking at basically you can run it all night. And then in the morning, you shut it off, but you got to fill it up again for the next night. You're going to run out of fuel.
That's right. That's right. You know, and if you haven't put additives in your gasoline, if you're saying, well, I have a 2-year supply of gasoline to run a generator for craziness, well, it'll only run it for a year because unless you put additives in your gasoline, it's not going to go longer than a year.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, those are... Yeah, and there's all kinds of, you can get a propane generator, you can go get diesel, it doesn't matter, you made the point. How much fuel do you have? And so, you know, then it becomes something where people have to find alternate resources.
Well, I got a question for you now.
There's serious
concerns. We're talking about, well, we're almost out of time. Almost time for the next break. We're talking about how the telegraph cables, telegraph wires arced. What about that cell phone in your pocket?
Well, the devices that we have in our pocket are pretty well hardened for EMP. Your iPods, your cell phones. I'm not seeing them being a threat that they would explode on you. Necessarily. I mean, some of the older ones, that could be an issue. You know, there were some old cell phones that had a problem with if you were talking to them and charging them at the same time, they could catch fire on your hands.
Mm-hmm.
But that was something that they corrected some time back. So I think they're pretty well hardened for EMP, but not so much so that the EMP is not going to toast the circuitry.
Mm-hmm.
And, electronics runs very, very small voltages. So you have an EMP pulse that hits it. You know, I mean, that's like a tsunami blowing through the machine. It'll cook it in its own juices. So you can see that. And for folks that want to make sure that, you know, if the cellular systems can come up, and cellular systems are actually fairly survivable. So are the old pots,
Marshall, we'll have to pick up there when we come back. We have to step away, folks, for a break. We'll be back, though, and I hope you will be, too. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and for those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. It is a delight to have you with us. I'm glad you're here, and please accept my expression of deepest sympathy for whatever it is that kept you away from the first hour. But this second hour is now up on us. I'm here, Marshall Masters is here, and now you're here, so welcome aboard. Marshall, when we had to step away for break, you were about to tell us something about people that want to protect their devices in the event of this kind of solar activity.
Yeah, one of the things that you can do, and we describe all of this, we have a book, Planet X Forecast and 2012 Survival Guide, and it deals with all the same threats that you're going to have to face with the kind of situation we're talking with Comet Elenin. You have EMP, radiation, how deep do you go, where do you find yourself, these kind of things. And that's all mapped out in Planet X Forecast. One of the things we can, a little couple of tips I can throw at you out of the book is, you know, I'm sure, you know, with all the experience that you have out in the field, you know, you got those tins of fruitcake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, you know, they're so, the stuff's so heavy that you could either eat it or throw it at the enemy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that folks should do is, if you got those fruitcake tins around, any kind of these tins that are used for storing food are great. First thing you want to do is make sure you get some fine sandpaper and scrape away the lacquer that they put on the edges so there's metal-to-metal contact. Then you take your cell phones, whatever device that you have, and you remove the batteries. And, you know, this is a good thing to do, for example, with your old cell phone. And, you know, if you have a SIM card for it, you might go get yourself another SIM card. Sometimes, you know, you have one of the older SIM cards with an older phone, and it works just fine. But you can take that without the battery. You wrap it up in the plastic so nothing metallic can touch it. All right. Then around that, you wrap it in tin foil about three times and make sure that there's absolutely no openings. EMP radiation is like water. It is highly invasive. And so if you have a pinhole, you have no protection at all. It'll flow to that point and go right through that pinhole. So you got to make sure it's really tightened up. No metal is contacting it. Get that tin foil wrapped around it. Then what you do is you put that inside your fruit can and you seal that off. Now what you have is a very simple homemade Faraday cage. Now there are other things that you can do that are more elaborate as you go down the road. But this is something that is going to give you a fairly good level of protection. And you put your little devices in there. Another thing that you can do is get yourself an inverter. And this is there's the kind that you can use with cell phones. There's square wave and analog wave. Square wave stuff is pretty inexpensive. It's going to be under $50. Whereas the analog is going to be much more expensive. The difference between them is the little square wave units, like you can plug into your car and run your cell phone or your laptop off of that, are going to be fine for exactly those kind of devices. If you have a more expensive analog wave transformer, now you can, you know, you could take that and plug in power tools and the such. So, you know, if you're going to run a you need to get a saw, a jigsaw, to get through something. You don't want to do that on a square wave.
Yeah, but if the grid is down.
Those are little things that you can do.
But if the grid is down, you're not even going to have electricity for that.
Well, if the grid's down, you're not going to have electricity for that. But there's other things that you can do. You can jury rig, get an alternator off of a junked car. And you can rig that up to a bicycle, and you can generate enough electricity out of that to run a hairdryer.
Hmm.
So you could sit there and charge something. I mean, a good example of what it would look like, I mean, they have these in the third world. I'm sure you came across them quite often. But for someone who wants a visual experience, there's an old movie, Soylent Green, you know, and they've got one just like that, a little old generator they're using for charging up their batteries. So people will be resourceful. They'll find ways to do it. They're going to find ways to salvage whatever electronics that they can. Another thing that you can do that's going to be a good safety valve for you is if you're worried about an EMP event from a solar flare, and that's going to let you know if it's coming, there's radiation coming, it's going to pour down from directly on top of you for a while. And if you have like a small, you can go get those little FM receivers that you can plug into your ears. They're usually pretty cheap, $4 or $5. A lot of times just get them as a gift. You know, if you can get a bunch of those are great, particularly if you don't have to, the battery is something that could be removed. Because FM is very susceptible to this, and so if you're sitting there and you're listening, even if you're listening to static, you know that you got a problem the minute that thing goes and is dead. You know, that's it. It's either died a natural death or there's a, you know, you're in a storm and you got to get to ground. The thing of it
so you're saying use these FM
come in two waves.
You're saying use these little FM receivers as kind of a detector.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you can use them as a receiver, and this is something where you can set them to a low power. If there's someone in your survival group that's blind, has been for some time, their senses are going to be highly attuned, their hearing is going to be excellent, so they could play that little FM receiver to, you know, add a very low energy level that wouldn't be audible to you or me in some cases. So that is definitely something that, you know, makes a person useful. But what you have to remember is a solar storm is usually packs a 1-2 punch. First comes the radiation, which is going to get here at the speed of light. So it's about 8 minutes. There's no warning. It just starts happening. And if it's really bad, if we're in the crosshairs of something really bad, it's going to be an Earth standstill. You know, remember the day the Earth stood still, that movie?
Mm-hmm.
And the old one, the
yeah.
one that was, you know, Barada Nictu Klaatu, I think, or
yeah.
Klaatu Barada Nictu. But that's a kind of a situation there. That's something that folks can do in their planning. I think what's more important than that is right now, As a researcher, I can tell you that for those of us who have been following this for some time, doing this work, this is a very depressing time for us. Because the things that we've been talking about and dreading for years are coming to pass. And we're looking at what is happening in the world around us and the consequences of that in terms of impacting people's ability to survive a global cataclysm. And that is really eroding. And so it's this insanity of what's happening. You know, you're looking at a collapse of economic systems. Nations are becoming insolvent, you know, right now in Europe. What happens if Italy says that's it? You know, you either bail us or whatever. We're too big to fix, too big to fail. What the heck do they do with it? We have all these problems. And the reason why it's a concern for us is that on one hand, you know, we have been saying for years that people should be quietly gathering supplies. All right? You know, it's some people say, well, the smart thing to do is go buy an ounce of gold. I mean, what was the close on gold recently?
You're talking to the wrong guy.
Yeah, I mean, for what it costs for an ounce of gold, you can stockpile enough basic food supplies for a family of three or four for anywhere from 4 to 6 months.
Well, I don't have enough money to even spell gold, so... you know, that's the way it goes.
You're in good company these days.
All right. Yeah. I want to open up the telephone lines and allow our audience to participate in tonight's discussion. There are some of you in some parts of the world who were not able to get the show for most of that first hour. The rest of our feeds were working, but we did have one feed that apparently was either they were working on the servers or it was being blocked or something. But it's up now, and so the whole world can hear us. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. If you happen to be in the USA or Canada, please use that number. If you are outside of the USA or Canada, you can use that number or you can send me a flash message. And the way you send a flash message is go to my website. scroll down, and you'll see the picture about tonight's show. Well, right above that picture is the link that says Flash Message. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hi, Brent.
Hi, Kevin. Marshall,
hey, Brent.
I have one more thing. Hi, Marshall. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good.
Good. I have one thing I want to suggest before, if the power goes out, if the grid goes down, you're going to have a shovel, some wood, some nails, so you can dig yourself an outhouse. Sanitation comes first.
Good point.
I don't know. I think food comes first. If you don't have food, you won't need sanitation.
That's true, yeah. But you can, well, I mean, if you have sanitation, you're going to cut down disease.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I'm sure, you know, I mean, you've been around the world, Kev, and you've seen people dying of these diseases. It's not pretty.
That's true. That's true.
You know, so, I mean, your caller's point about that is really, really important, and particularly for folks that are, you know, living in the city, sanitation is really going to be a crisis issue. You know, I mean, where in New York can you dig a hole, right?
Yeah, especially if you're in the 50th story.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah, getting, and you know, nice thing about it, it takes electricity to get you up to the 50th story. And so those high rises are going to be essentially useless in that situation.
Let me tell you something that will happen, not might, will happen. And that is people who live above the 5th or 6th floor are not going to walk all that way down carrying the garbage bags. So you have to stay, you have to walk in the street because the sidewalk is a garbage bombing zone. Those are coming over the rail, over the balcony, and you won't even know which apartment it came from.
And they're going to be tossing their bedpans the same way. So if you're walking on the sidewalk, you could get a whole bunch of poop and pee all in you.
Yeah, and people that are listening may think I'm kidding. That's the way it was in Pristina, Kosovo, when I lived there. If you were not walking on a covered sidewalk, you didn't walk on the sidewalk. You got out in the street. You'd get bombed with garbage. Brent, did you have another question or comment?
I posted this yesterday on in the forums, so I didn't know what to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
A horse that stays in our corral was acting screwy yesterday, and I mean screwy. It did things that it has never done since it was broke to ride.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's a precursor to something else or what. So I just
could be.
Bren, where is it you're located now exactly?
Northeastern Wyoming.
Okay.
If you
how far are you from
Yellowstone?
Okay, you're
about 200 miles.
Okay. And you haven't seen your animal exhibiting this behavior before?
His owner has not seen this particular animal exhibiting this behavior in 20 years.
Good Lord. And what was the animal doing? Exactly.
Would walk
describe
up to
those
him.
Behaviors. I mean, excuse me.
I'll do it real quick.
Kev, I'm just doing some ad hoc research here.
Yeah, it's all right.
Okay, I got to go to work in a few minutes, but I'll do this real quick. He was,
okay.
He'd walk up to him to get caught, then he'd walk, turn around and run away. Did that twice.
Mm-hmm.
Then he, mm-hmm. when he went down and caught him with the halter rope, he got him halfway around to the front of the corral and horse pulled back and ran back to his home. Got him into his trailer a few minutes later, and that horse threw a fit in the trailer, going out to the fairgrounds and back. Once he got on him,
okay.
He was fine, but all transportation, he was nuts.
All right. And you never had problems with transport?
Never.
Wow. Wow. Then this, you know, one of the things this reminds me, did you ever hear of a fellow by the name of Jim Berkland? Scissorgy.org?
No.
I mean, I don't know if he's still running the site. Jim Berkland, I've met him. I had a chance. Actually, we went to a baseball game in San Francisco together, and that was a lot of fun. And, you know, way back when, I mean, this was back in, I think, 2004, and I was interviewing him, and we were talking about Yellowstone, because about that time, Yellowstone was put on a red level alert for a seismic event, and or a volcano event. Well, and it's never come off. I mean, it's still on, and, you know, this is, wow, I mean, this is something that is, in that neck of the woods, it would be something that would put the hair up on his neck, because one of the ways, he's the guy that the Loma Prieta earthquake that happened in 1989, all right, I was in that quake. Matter of fact, I was only about 10 miles south of the stadium where the World Series was, and I can tell you, it was scary as heck. I was in an industrial park that was built on landfill. And the thing of it is that Birkeland predicted that quake, and he was off by, you know, just a matter of a couple of hours on the time. And two things that he did to predict that. One was he was looking for lost animal reports, animals acting, behaving strangely, running away. So he's looking at classified ads. Today it'd have to be Craigslist. But he's going through the papers, looking at classified ads, people saying, my kitty's lost, my dog's lost, you know, posting a reward and whatnot. The other thing he was looking at was there any change in normal venting going on? Now, there's one...
Let me just say to the caller, if you'll just hang on, we'll get to you in a minute. Go ahead.
And so the thing is that there's a geyser. It's up there in Marin County, up there in the wine country. And it's the only one that's in the state. You know, you have to go to Yellowstone for another geyser. I've been up there, seen it. They got a seismic station there. And what Birkeland was saying is that thing, which was just as regular as Old Faithful in Yellowstone, started acting weird. And that was when he knew something was happening, because you got the ground pressure underneath there. So, you know, you got the magma movement. Something's happening. Something's going on there. And, you know, the next question I would say then to you, listener, is to be vigilant for any reports of other animals behaving the same way. You know, one of the things I remember him saying is, if the buffalo start running out of Yellowstone, you ought to follow them, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Have you had any other animal reports similar to this one?
Not recently, no. Let's take this call.
Okay.
Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Debbie from Columbus.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Hello, Marshall. Thanks for being on the show. Kev, you made a comment earlier about the food.
Uh-huh.
We actually... if we unfortunately come into a situation like that, you're going to need water a lot more quicker than you're going to need food. You can last for about 3 to 4 months without food, roughly. You can't last more than maybe a week without water. And I'm talking potable.
Yeah,
water. I'm talking, you know, water that's sanitized in here.
Uh-huh.
There's, well, I mean, water for sanitizing, whatever water you have on hand. You know, it's generally, you know, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food, and that's it. But the number one priority is exposure. You have to have air, okay? So if you have a problem with breathing, you're going to die. I mean, think back to 9/11, all those people running out down the street with their faces caked, okay? And it was really hard for them to breathe. People were coming out with bottles of water and washing it off their face. Now, one thing you can do, everybody out there, if you've got a coffee maker, uses a number 4 filter. They're very small. You can fold it up, put it in your pocket, put it in your wallet, put it in your purse. It's not going to protect you from noxious gases, but it's going to keep the particulates out of your mouth so that you don't wind up with a sludge in your lungs. In terms of water, you're absolutely right. You know, if something like that happens, do not flush your toilets. Your toilet, if you're, and don't use the tablets and, you know, all the, you know, you can put the blue tablets or whatever in toilets. I mean, unless you have water set aside somewhere else, you could do that. But otherwise, a toilet tank is anywhere from 3 to 5 gallons of potable water if there's no chemical in it. So don't flush it. I mean, the first thing you really want to do is just literally go and disassemble the handle off the toilet tank and protect that as a water supply. But you're going to, you know, a lot of people are going to be able to find enough water to get them going for a couple of days. Food, on the other hand, is going to be a real long-term issue. And that's the problem there is you're going to start seeing food riots. It's going to get ugly.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. And the telephone line is open if you have a question or comment to address to Marshall. That's what you need to do. You need to call that telephone number. Now, if you happen to be outside of the USA and you happen to be outside of Canada, then we understand that international long-distance calls are expensive. So we have another feature on the website for you. You can call that number, 623-444-5889. Or, for those of you who are outside the USA and outside of Canada, you can send me a flash message. And you do that by going over to my website, scroll down till you see the picture about tonight's show. And when you see the picture about tonight's show, there's a link right above it that says flash message. Okay? From Thailand, we have a flash message from Nek, and he says, Marshall, like you stated that the unknown of the gravity pull of the sun will have on the comet, will the comet fly near enough to be crushed by the sun?
No, I mean, it can. I think that there's a possibility that it could outburst and come apart like S4 Linear did back in 2000, as I recall. So there's a lot of variables here. I mean, when it comes to LNN, it has the hallmarks of a lot of other weird anomalies we've observed with comets over the years. And personally, ask me, I would just like to see it be a wimpy little thing that flies by without a problem. On the other hand, it could be. And so, I mean, it's necessary for folks to just normal preparation. You know, in other words, it's like, how do you prepare for a comet doing that? How do you prepare for this other thing? How do you prepare? Well, it always comes down to the same basic things. You got to have air. You got to be careful about exposure. You got to keep your core body heat stable. You know, if you look what's happening in this heat wave, people are dying in the heat wave because, I mean, they're sitting there and they're having heat disease.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. And we will take your calls, hear your comments and questions.
United Kingdom, and you are listening to the fantastic Kevin Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Marshall Masters. And Marshall, you know, some of what we haven't talked about is something that really you're more famous for. And that is the approach of Planet X, Planet Nibiru. A lot of people are beginning to say, well, okay, we're only 1 year out. Why can't we see it yet? What would you say?
All right. Well, first off, what we have always said consistently is, 2013 is the year. To us, 2012 is like a warm-up band. The headline act comes in 2013. And we've been seeing that for a number of years. What I found interesting is that Torah code research, which is, you've heard of Drazen's Bible code, which is kind of a small subset of Torah code that goes back almost 1,000 years, that Jewish scholars have been following this, finding hidden codes in the Bible. And the one thing that we found, you know, I'm working up here in a new production called Watchers 2 from Pinlight Productions, and they found a reference to Planet X for 2012, just one. However, in 2013, they find several. And but interestingly enough, under the old Aramaic name of Nabiru, and which is how it's pronounced in the Middle East. So we're still finding that there is a tremendous amount of information about Planet X. It's coming through. When we, you know, everyone says 2012. It's really not accurate. You're talking about the last few weeks of 2012. You're talking about December, and not even the full month of December. There's a solstice. So there's a date there. And that, you know, what we see as a general pattern is that we have between now and then, it's a little more over a year. I think that in terms of the approach of Planet X, all of the indicators, harbingers that we were looking for are there. In my new book, Crossing the Cusp, Surviving the Edgar Cayce Pole Shift, I decoded the Avebury 2008 formation. And yeah, I mean, National Geographic is off on their little hoaxer thing, and they slam dunk that, and any kind of paranormal topic they're going to trash, because the elites really don't want people to look at this. But that was an authentic formation, almost the size of 4 soccer fields, huge, and appeared in 2 phases, and which were interlocking, by the way, and with surgical precision. And it has a very clear time stamp of the winter solstice of 2012. And what that formation, as I decode it, tells us is that we will see this object in the sky in the early part of December 2012. All right. Then after that is when things really start to heat up into 2013, going into 2014. So we haven't seen anything that has dissuaded us from the Planet X information that we have and that we've published. It just seems to keep piling on more and more.
You mentioned the
now,
elite don't want us to know.
Visible. Hmm?
You mentioned the elite don't want us to know about all this. Why?
Very simple. Who's going to do the greatest amount of dying? The last to know. And that's what they want, is the greatest amount of dying.
Yeah, but okay, why? Because when all this is over, the fewer people they have under them, the fewer the smaller power and smaller wealth they have.
Not really, because their bag is the exploitation of the planet. All right. I mean, if you look at all the economic crisis we have in the world, the global system is collapsing under its own weight. It's debt ridden with fractional banking reserves or whatever. You have to have, for any currency, you have to have a value basis. And what we have are fiat currencies. But there is a value basis. It has been the ease with which the resources of the planet were being exploited. Well, we're capping out on that in a number of different ways. And at the same time, demand is growing for what's left. So you're talking about, yeah, it's harder to get oil at a good price. They can find plenty of oil, and, you know, they're going, wow, whoopee, the ice is melting in the Arctic. You know, plant the flag and go drill like crazy, okay? So global warming has actually given them access to new oil fields, and they're going for that. And there's a huge race up there, and, I mean, it's getting, you know, militaristic up there, where nations are sending submarines to monitor things. We are, you know, it's getting crazy like that. So, you know, I think, but getting back to your original question, why is it we can't see it? All right. Now, I do have a video, Planet X Special Report, on my YouTube channel. youtube.com/yowbooks, Y-O-W-B-O-O-K-S. And go to the Planet X Special Report number 1. I did that some time back. And I explain in very precise, specific reasons why this object is not going to become visible until shortly before it's a problem. And the ancients tell us that is what happens. It's unlike anything else we've ever seen, and it sneaks up on you. And this is a very dark object. It's coming up from the southern skies. We know it's coming up from the southern skies because the Ulysses probe that has been in a polar orbit, all right, you know, that probe, they finally had the last bit of research, I think it was back, you know, a few years ago. Of course, every time a NASA probe gets really close to something really interesting, it develops some sort of mechanical problem, and they don't report the data from that point. But what we did get from the data streams was that the southern hemisphere of the sun is definitely more active than the northern hemisphere, and it is active pointing out into a region of space. It's not where the whole southern hemisphere is, you know, like a light bulb and just glowing brighter. You can see in the Ulysses data, and this is reported on our site at YOWUSA.com. So we know it's coming in from the south. That is exactly what is said in the Avebury 2008 formation, which I believe is to a warning to us from extraterrestrials or whoever made the crop circle, you don't know. But, I mean, they have identified themselves in 2001, 2002, and again this year we're seeing more of them where they're actually presenting themselves as the appearance of grays. But, you know, the object, if it's coming in from the south, one thing you have to remember is that 90% of all the observations we make are near the ecliptic. You know, remember, go back talking about the ecliptic, like as you called it, Kevin, the equator of the solar system.
Yeah.
90% of those observations are there. The other 10% are above or below that, and I would say out of the remaining 10%, 8% is above the ecliptic, and another 2% is below. So you're really effectively talking about 2% of the resources of the planet could spot this thing. We do, back in 2008, I published disclosure videos that came out of the South Pole Telescope. I'm also the guy that broke the story on that, and where it is showing images of this, and it's a mini constellation with a brown dwarf and several satellites orbiting it. So this is coming in, but it's occluded. It has a dust field around it. It's something that can be spotted with infrared if you know what area of space to look at, and we're, you know, absolutely certain that the government is monitoring it. We know that there were two videos that were very authentic because they unleashed a horrendous torrent of disinformation attacks against me and the poor folks that were putting those things out there. I mean, it was just outright ugly. And we're not talking about cranks and trolls and all of that stupid idiot thinking to say that's what's happening. People don't understand what's happening on the internet. I see it. I work in it. I've been doing this for years. The level of disinformation being pumped in by paid, organized disinformationalists is massive. All right. Now, why is it, you were saying, Kevin, well, they have fewer people? The point of it is that with organic farming, or the kind of farming that was done up to World War II, all right, natural organic farming, much healthier foods. The foods we eat now are awful. I mean, we have to go out and supplement with vitamins and minerals when we shouldn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
There really is enough in nature to keep us going, but not when crops are, you know, the fields are being depleted. We are in a petrochemical bubble. I would venture to say that there are some 4.5 billion people on the planet right now that are alive for one reason only: petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides. Oil to run the tractors, to transport stuff. You buy an apple, it comes to you from thousands of miles away. What happened to, you know, I remember as a kid, I could go to the store, and when apples were in season, there were 20 varieties from local farmers, and they were all incredibly delicious. All right? And they looked more than pretty. You know, when you bit into them, you could taste it. Today, I get an apple in the store, and it just feels like sweet paper in my mouth. And if you take a knockout, it's not an oil shortage issue. It's not running out of petroleum issue. People have to understand, set that aside. It's oil infrastructure. Think back to Katrina. It took out a huge amount of oil infrastructure in the Gulf. The result was the cost of food and fuel went real high. Remember those times?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, you take out the infrastructure with a whole bunch of cataclysms, and all of a sudden there are no more terminals and refineries and whatnot. What you have are farmers that need petrochemicals, and a lot of the farming today, because our Supreme Court sold us out like a pack of Nazis to Monsanto, and they're putting family farmers out of business because they want to grow heritage seeds. They want genetically modified garbage, and these seeds, you know, they say it's because it grows better. Wrong. It doesn't. Natural seeds produce better. But the whole thing is everything is structured around Monsanto and the oil companies, and if those systems fail, we're in deep yogurt, because we do not have, if we use the energy of the sun, what mankind has used since we first started putting seeds in the earth, we use the energy of the sun. That's what we survive on. And at best, if we are living frugally and smartly, the planet could support 2 billion people that way. But not when we're, you know, sitting here with massive population, 6.75 billion and growing.
All right. So let's take this call.
We're going to start with that.
Let's take this call. We'll get part of it in before the break takes over. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
It's Francois from Montreal.
Hello, Francois.
Hello, Kevin. Francois. Hello, Mr. Marshall. Mr. Marshall. Hello, Mr. Marshall. Mentioned that Eleni's gonna come first, and then Nibiru's gonna be behind. And
if it's the Blue Kachina, and if it plays out that way, yes.
Okay, during the breaks, I was on the disclosed TV of the forum, and there's a video with just sound, and there's a guy named Arizona who claims to be a friend with someone in working on a telescope in New Zealand. And give the coordinate of Nibiru. He says that Nibiru is 170,000 miles in the diameter.
All right, we have to take a break, Francois. Hang on. We'll get back to you right after this break. Don't go away, folks. More with Marshall Masters right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Marshall Masters, and on the phone with us is Francois from Canada. Francois, I'm going to have to ask you to make it quick because we're running out of time.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah.
So the coordinate of Nibiru can be seen from the southern hemisphere. If somebody has a pen under their hand, it's 9 hours, 47 minutes, 50 seconds, 0.30 seconds, 13 degrees, 6 feet, and 44 inches.
Okay.
Just like in case the thing is serious, you know.
Yeah. All right, Francois, good to hear from you again. Thanks for the call.
Francois, send me a link to that. Email it to info@yowza.com. Thanks.
Okay, we've got a flash message here from Tony in Australia. Hi, Kevin and Marshall. I just want to say, Marshall, for some time now, I've been following you. You're doing a great job in informing the world of what's about to occur. Unfortunately, too many are laughing at us. I wonder sometimes if I'm the only one who cares about this. Thanks, guys, and keep up the great work. All the best, Tony. Tony, thanks for the flash message.
Tony, you're not alone.
No. I would not say that people who are awake and aware and alert are in the majority, but certainly you're not alone. Okay, we have a flash message from Brian in Australia. And Brian says, thanks, Kevin, for the free downloads, and thanks to Marshall for his time. Has there been any research as to where the nearest geological point will be when LNN is at its closest to Earth? How long might Earth be directly affected by the passing? And Marshall, I'll have to ask you to speed this one along because we have one more call to take.
Sure. If in a worst case scenario, we already forecasted that out, it could go, we could be having volcanism and seismicity as a result of this through the end of this year and into January of next. You know, in a worst case scenario. It's a lot of, you know, folks, there's a lot of sketchy data on it. It's fluid. It's changing. There's a huge amount of disinformation and it's really hard to call it out. But one thing is undeniable, you know, this sudden brightening. So,
all right, let's take this call.
Just prepare.
Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Skye from Alabama.
Hello, Skye.
And I have a question, and I'll take my answer off the air. But when this happens, where do you have an opinion on where the safest places to live would be?
Well, Skye, good question. In general, what you want to do is, I mean, you got to be aware of your own situation. If you live along a coast and you're right at sea level, not good. You want to be inland, have some elevation. In general, you want to find places with soft earth, rolling hills, and spring-fed artesian water as a source. And those are going to be your best ones. But most important is if you're just aware of what is happening in the world around you, you have good situational awareness, you're monitoring stuff, you're going to know when it's time to bug out. And if you have a 24-hour edge, that's it. That's all you have is a 24-hour edge. What does it buy you? It buys you clear roads, easy access to fuel, all the supplies you want, and your choice of lodging. After that, it's a zoo. So it's the little things, folks, that can do it. Now, you know, I just want to say, Kevin, one of my friends over at Greenland Energy, Dan Dean, and we go canoeing, you know, out in the wilderness sometimes. And his business right now, he's going from can to can. He does electrical systems for off-the-grid homes and businesses, but the big part of his business that's exploding is electrical off-the-grid systems for deep underground personal survival bunkers. The people that are doing this are spending at a minimum entry level $500,000. Typically it's $1 to $2 million. They're building luxury underground survival bunkers, and the growth right now, this is huge. I am seeing this. I get these people contacting me. They want to make sure, you know, they'll buy a book and then ask me what's a good location. I always accommodate people and tell them that way. Folks, I can tell you, anyone that's involved in managing or working in risk on a daily basis, whether they're investors or managing investments or evaluating investments or whatever, these people are not quibbling. I am seeing them very proactive. They are spending a heck of a lot of money. They're not questioning it, because for them, it's a threshold issue. At some point, you have to say the risk is really substantial, and you always hope it doesn't have. But they're doing what they're doing for the same reason that everyone else buys car insurance or fire insurance for your house. you got a what? You know, a small infinitesimal possibility that your house is going to catch fire. You're going to pay on that insurance forever. So we have no problem justifying it. So for people who understand risk, they're busting big, big moves. And, you know, the only questions they ask me are about location. When it comes to the rest of it, man, they're going top flight. I mean, here's a good example. Not only do they build these multi-million dollar underground luxury condominium survival bunkers with jacuzzis and big screen TVs. I am serious. This is really happening. But they will have the construction crews brought in from 300 to 400 miles away so that the people who build their bunkers are not going to be anywhere near those bunkers when the guacamole hits the fan. Because the last thing you need is some guy that was putting in, you know, insulation for you, and he knows how to dig you out like a cockroach and take what you got. So the people that have the money, they're not quibbling. They're busting big moves right now.
And big bucks.
Big bucks. Huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
Okay, Marshall, as we are kind of racing toward the end of the show here, let me ask you this. Based on everything that you've looked at, now I know we've talked about a lot of the research and that it's fluid and things are changing, but based on everything that you have looked at, do you think that Comet Elenine is going to be a catastrophe causer?
I think right now, and I can only talk from a gut instinct level, all right, as a researcher.
Okay.
But, and it's something that I've always felt it for almost near the beginning. I knew it was important. I always knew it was important. I had to get through the nonsense about it. I think that it's going to be a harbinger. I think there is going to be events, and there's going to be lives lost, and it's going to be, frankly, a point in time when everybody's standing out in their front yard pointing up at the sky and crapping their collective pants and knowing that life as we know it is definitely gone. It's toast. There's going to be something else happening. That, there's no question in my mind. Now, whether it's Elenin or Planet X or something else in between, there's going to be a harbinger before things really, really get out of hand. That, I am completely convinced that we will see. And when that happens, when those events happen, it's serious. But look what's happening in the world already. Civilization as we know it is, look at the trouble we're in. You got nations imploding. These are all things that, I mean, we published Planet X forecast in 2012 Survival Guide back in 2007. All of the predictions we made about economics and where we're at right now are absolutely dead on the money. I got it dead on the money. Years in advance. I said it was real simple. Once the price of oil went over $100 a barrel and hung there, not a little spike, but it hung there, then we would begin to see economic contractions. And what have we had? A series of economic contractions since that happened.
All right, Marshall, stay online with me. And ladies and gentlemen, that's unfortunately going to have to be it for this evening. It's a wrap. We've run out of time. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.